Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we've had the privilege of tapping from time to time is with us once again, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, retired. He has a distinguished record of service to our country, both in the uniform of the Army, including in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also as a medical researcher, something he has been trained for. He's brought those skills to bear at Fort Detrick, Army's biodefense program, and also in the private sector. And he's been a successful business executive as well as medical researcher. He is a wonderful guest. We're always pleased to have him with us and have a lot to talk with him about, a subject on which he's been both deeply informed and very illuminating, namely Afghanistan. Colonel, Dr. Sellin, welcome back. It's good to have you with us. You have been making the rounds of programs here and abroad, describing in, I think, very illuminating, as I say, ways, what has befallen the people of Afghanistan and at our hands, the world, and what it is likely to mean for both those now subject to the not-so-tender mercies of the Taliban, and for, well, this country and the free world. And we're going to talk about all of those topics with you in the generous time you're giving us. Let me start by just noting that someone who is also making similar observations to your own was just featured on Tucker Carlson Today program on Fox Nation. That would be investigative journalist Laura Logan. And I'd like to bounce off of you a couple of themes that she sounded that I think are, again, very much along the lines of your own thoughts. She talked specifically about Pakistan and the role that the Pakistanis have played in the nightmare that has been our conflict in Afghanistan, and the policies of our own country towards the Pakistanis. Would you give us your thoughts on the Pakistan phenomenon in all of this, and the contribution it's made to the present, well, it seems to me, humiliating strategic defeat of the United States?
Well, Pakistan has always been a problem, and in my opinion, it's the main problem where the United States did not succeed in Afghanistan, because they never recognized that the war in Afghanistan was not an insurgency. It was actually a proxy war being waged by Pakistan against Afghanistan, because Islamic terrorism is actually an element of Pakistan's foreign policy. I think we've seen over the years the attacks from Pakistan on India by Islamic terrorists that are hosted by Pakistan. And Pakistan has always considered from the very beginning that Afghanistan should be a client state of Pakistan. Pakistan tried to influence Afghanistan starting already in the 1950s, where they tried to insert Islamists into the Afghan political system, and failed to do so. They tried Islamic coups both in 1997 1977 and 1978. And one of the big problems that the United States caused itself was during the Soviet occupation and the war by the Mujahideen. Essentially, the CIA outsourced the supply of both money and arms to the Pakistan Intelligence Services, the ISI. And so they controlled the supply to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan who were fighting the Soviets. So what the Pakistanis did was essentially supply and give money to only those groups that supported Pakistan and neglected Afghan nationalists. So the problem has always been that Pakistan has hosted the Taliban, created the Taliban, and hosted the Taliban.
And when you say that they were waging a proxy war against Afghanistan, I guess what strikes me is that they were also waging it against us as a practical matter by supporting the Taliban, by supporting and arming it and ensuring that it was in the fight, which makes all the more stunning points that Laura made about the extent to which we were enabling the Pakistanis to do that. That, as she put it, we basically paid for the Pakistani military and intelligence services. We'll come to the sponsorship of Pakistan by China in a moment, but just walk us through the double game that was being played by the Pakistanis over these past two decades and the contribution it's made to not only the loss of American lives over these years and the vastly larger loss of Afghan lives, of course, but also the outcome of the moment.
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. The Pakistan created the Taliban, so they not only created it, but they hosted it in Pakistan, starting with they had four shuras, which were basically command and control centers by the Taliban all along the Pakistan border. So not only that, but in these places where they had these command and control centers, these four command and control centers inside Pakistan, the Taliban were recruiting, they were training, they had rest and recuperation centers, and even the wounded Taliban were being treated in Pakistani hospitals. I actually have a photograph of one Taliban who was treated in a hospital near Quetta, and it was actually paid by the Pakistani government $82 a day while he was in the hospital. So they had all the facilities to wage war from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So this is completely controlled and assisted by the Pakistani government, and in particular the Pakistani intelligence services, at the same time where we were giving money to the Pakistan military and supporting them. And all these centers were essentially militarily off limits. So there was actually no way we could win the war because the Taliban had sanctuaries in Pakistan all during the time that we were fighting.
Were we turning a blind eye to this double game by the Pakistanis? It's unimaginable that we were unaware. Obviously, the sanctuaries were there, but the direct role that the Pakistani government, the ISI, the intelligence service, and so on, were playing in enabling the Taliban to wage war against us and our Afghan allies throughout this period.
Well, I served in Afghanistan twice, Frank, and it was well known among the soldiers there that Pakistan was supporting the Taliban, and at the same time we were funding Pakistan. So this was not a secret. It was known both to the Afghans and to the U.S. Army, and I've never understood why we tolerated this, because it made winning the conflict really impossible, because we couldn't go to really the source of the problem, which was inside Pakistan.
Right. Laura Logan's theory is that it was just rank corruption, that both within the military itself, our military, that is, within the executive branch, and she particularly put a bullseye on the Congress and the role of its sort of permanent staff bureaucracy, that was clearly subject to intense lobbying and highly effective lobbying, apparently, by the Pakistanis. We also know that the Pakistanis ran influence operations and spy rings on Capitol Hill over the years. So all of this, I'm sure, contributed, if doesn't fully explain this willful blindness. But what it certainly underscores, Colonel Sullen, is that this mission was doomed to fail insofar as we were giving the Pakistanis a pass. And not only that, but billions and billions and billions of dollars, no less, to enable them to wage this proxy war against both us and our friends in Afghanistan. So this brings me to the next point, which is China and the role that China has been playing in this conflict to date. Through, if the Taliban are proxies for the Pakistanis, I think it's fair to say the Pakistanis are proxies for the Chinese, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. The Pakistan has always been a close ally of China. It never has been an ally of the United States. In fact, China calls Pakistan, or they call each other, all-weather allies, that they will always be allies under all circumstances. So behind all this is China, in fact. And what I expect to happen is, China has always been interested in controlling South Asia. And what I expect to happen is that, among other places, yes, but I expect China to recognize the Taliban government very quickly. And I also expect them to try to implement their plan for economic and military dominance of South Asia. Now, this is going to involve China encouraging Afghanistan to join the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is the flagship of China's Belt and Road Initiative. I also expect China to start exploiting Afghanistan's mineral wealth, which is huge. And I also expect that China will begin to build military bases in Balochistan, Balochistan province in Pakistan, which is on the Arabian Sea, and at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. And this will actually, these military bases, which I know are being planned, will link up with the Chinese military base, naval base in Djibouti, which is at the mouth of the Red Sea and the entrance of the Suez Canal. So it'll link to that and also be the other link with the military bases that China is expanding in the South China Sea. With their intention is to control the vital sea lanes, not only the Persian Gulf, but all along the northern Indian Ocean.
Colonel Sullen, you've got a very impressive strategic overview of what's going on here, and I think your observation that the Chinese have been behind all of this speaks to something I talked about in my commentary today, and that is when Laura Logan talks about, as she put it in her conversation with Tucker Carlson, quote, "The Afghans will tell you the United States chose this outcome," unquote. My suspicion is that Joe Biden was told to choose this outcome by the people who have deeply compromised him and his family and so many others in his administration, namely the Chinese Communist Party. And one of the things, and I'd just be interested in your response to this, that it seems to me is now absolutely necessary. You know, there's increasing talk about impeaching Joe Biden over all of this, among other, I think, acts of omission or commission, malfeasance, subversion. But in the last impeachment, the second impeachment of Donald Trump, a transcript of a conversation between then-President Trump and the Ukrainian president featured prominently. It would seem to me that we have at least as compelling a need to know what were the contents of the so-called conversation between President Biden and Chinese Communist Party General Secretary Xi Jinping back in February, a 2-hour-long conversation. Now, for those of us who've been watching Joe Biden, it's simply unimaginable that he could sustain a conversation of any kind for 2 hours, even back then, a few months back. My contention is that were we to have such a transcript available, it might well show Xi Jinping using the opportunity essentially to dictate to this compromised president of the United States, and may well shed light on, among other things, the kinds of things that the Chinese wanted him to do in and to Afghanistan. This is conjecture, I grant you, but I'd be very interested in your response.
Well, in my opinion, there's no doubt in my mind that Joe Biden is compromised by China, and his whole family is compromised. But it goes far beyond that. The people around Joe Biden are compromised by China. If you look at his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, he has a long history of working with various organizations that have very close links with the Chinese Communist Party. The same goes for...
And before you leave that, worse yet, espousing explicitly and repeatedly China's so-called rise as a good thing and something to be not only welcomed but encouraged.
Yes, absolutely. And it also the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, again has a long history of connections with the Chinese Communist Party. So I think it goes back to what you just said. They see China as the rising power. They want to manage the decline of the United States, largely for financial benefit, perhaps their own financial benefit, but certainly for the globalists who are supporting the rise of China. They would prefer to see a Chinese-type government in the United States, one which is state capitalism plus totalitarianism. So I think all these threads are pointing towards some type of accommodation by the people in power in Washington, D.C. today and Communist China.
You know, on this question of how expansive is the compromise of senior folks in this administration, starting, of course, with Joe Biden himself, some of our colleagues associated with the Committee on the Present Danger, China, Lawrence, have done some very, very valuable research and documentation of, I think, over 20 individuals now, some in the legislative branch, but mostly in the executive branch, who have these kinds of compromises in their background. It can be found, folks, at accountabilityinitiative.org, and I really commend it to everyone. You cannot understand what's going on without having some appreciation for the degree to which this president has selected and entrusted in key portfolios, many of them having to do with China, by the way, people who are, I'm afraid, in China's pocket. And it does go some way to explaining how this, humiliating strategic defeat has come to pass, I think. But we need to see the transcript of this this conversation to get greater understanding of what has been done, who's making the calls, and to whose benefit. Lawrence, let me just ask you to drill down on something you touched on there, because it's something that I think is a sort of context for all of this. We have clearly an elite that is seemingly now really enthralled with this globalist agenda. The Great Reset is what Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum in Davos calls it. And it seems to be something that is embraced by a growing number of people in corporate boardrooms in this country, certainly in the financial sector, and in academia, and in the media, and in political life, all of which I think it's easy to document is something that the Chinese have been working assiduously to cultivate. But I'm interested in your vision of the relationship between the globalists on the one hand and the Chinese Communist Party on the other. Do they have, as you see it, not only a shared immediate agenda, namely taking down this country, but a common vision of what comes next, or do they have different outcomes in mind, but are willing to make common cause against the immediate foe, namely us, and then we'll sort out their differences subsequently? What's your take on all of that?
Well, I think they all have the same point of view. Both the Chinese Communist Party and the globalists, which you just described, they don't see the United States, or China for that matter, they don't see it as a country. They see it as a land and people to exploit. So that's the basic idea that they have. So they don't believe in nationalism, and therefore they would like just to have not have any countries at all, but have some type of world government. And in order for that world government to function, there would have to be some type of state capitalism, and certainly authoritarian, if not totalitarian, in order to control these populations. So I think these people basically have the same view of how to exploit land and people, and nationalism just gets in the way of that.
Are you suggesting then that these capitalists, as they've been described, global capitalists to be sure, are really communists at heart, or are at least comfortable with the prospect that a Chinese communist-style economic and political system would be the end state towards which their reset actually is driving us?
Yes, they're basically authoritarians. You know, they see a government like China as being preferable to a messy democracy. So they agree on those basic points, the type of government that they need to have in order to exploit both the land and the people. And the Chinese, they see the Chinese Communist Party as the route to do that.
We're often told, of course, that they are capitalists, but perhaps it's a more accurate way to describe them as sort of fascists, in the sense that the state working with the, you know, sort of private sector can accomplish the kind of exploitation that you're describing. And it certainly is antithetical to freedom and the kind of country that we have been privileged to live in and love and serve in our various capacities, and must be resisted, it seems to me, at every turn. Lawrence, speaking of all of this, there has been, as a very important focus of your efforts and research of late, an especially ominous vector in the, well, the Chinese call it unrestricted warfare that they have been waging against this country for decades, and that would be biological warfare. We only have a few minutes left, but could you give us sort of an overview of your assessment at this moment as to the nature of that biological warfare program, its objectives, and how what's happened to us as a result of this, well, I think of it as the CCP virus, is a portent of what may be to come at the hands of the Chinese communists?
Well, first of all, China's biological warfare program is massive. It is not just contained in the military. They have a core program in the military, which is secret, which covers all their military research institutes and their hospitals. But it also includes what we would consider civilian universities and civilian research centers. In China, there's no difference between military and civilian research, and they have mandated the fusion of those sectors. So they see it as part of their unrestricted warfare program. It is not, according to their military doctrine, it's not just to be used during war, it's to be used pre-war, and I think COVID-19 is certainly an example of that, where you have a destabilizing or debilitating, or economically debilitating virus, which essentially has given China an upper hand in the world because they were falling behind. So that was very useful. They're also have been thoroughly infiltrating our R&D sector in the United States. So in essence, we have been supplementing China's biological warfare program through the presence of People's Liberation Army and communist Chinese scientists in the United States, working in the United States, not only tapping into our knowledge and skills, but actually using U.S. government funding to support the program that is operating within communist China.
You talked about this a little bit with us last week, I know, but it's just stupefying that this kind of penetration has taken place, not only to the extent where we're providing, as you say, research insights and tools and financing for their biological warfare program over there in Wuhan, notably, but elsewhere as well, I think, but that we've been training and affording opportunities for heavens only knows how widespread technology transfers from our own research institutions here in the United States through Chinese nationals, some of whom are PLA, People's Liberation Army officers, back to the motherland. And I mean, like the unbelievable story that we've just described with respect to our willful blindness about Pakistan and China's role behind it in taking us down there in Afghanistan. This story about the biological warfare program is simply so gobsmacking, I guess is the only way to describe it, that it's a real criminal indictment, it seems to me, against, well, some of the prominent figures in the government today, but it has to be said, to some extent at least, those who've been in positions of power and influence in the past as well. And I cannot express adequately, Lawrence Sullen, my appreciation for the tenacious, rigorous, and highly informed way in which you have gone about documenting these travesties and bringing them to light through various platforms, including this one. And it's so vital if we are to save this republic that we be clear-eyed about these enemies, foreign, well, and domestic.
Yes, yes, indeed, Frank. I completely agree. I think we've been neglecting what I would describe as medical intelligence and our ability to not only understand what the Chinese are doing in biological warfare, but also the extent of the infiltration that has transpired over the last 30 years, again, accessing not our skills and knowledge, but also our funding. And the problem is that this is continuing. I mean, this is still in operation. There are still PLA and Chinese Communist Party scientists in the United States working with their colleagues in mainland China and using U.S. funding to do it, and it's not stopped.
Let me just a concluding question, I guess, to you, and we could spend another hour easily talking about this, but you've served in, as I mentioned, the uniform of the United States Army with distinction. You've been in and around some of the most sensitive programs in our country, as well as, you know, some of the wars in which we've been involved. You have experience in business and in medical research. Let me just ask you, speaking to an American audience of patriots, I'm quite sure, how are we to explain the absence of effective, well, counterintelligence at a minimum, or for that matter, any other sort of adult supervision with respect to such momentous things as, you know, understanding the nature of the war we're in Afghanistan, for example, or understanding the degree to which we may be greatly empowering our most mortal adversary, namely the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, I think, first of all, our intelligence agencies are no longer objective. They've been completely politicized. So what they're doing is not feeding objective data to the politicians. But they're altering it in such a way that it is more acceptable to the views of those politicians. So it's really been influenced by our own politics, which has infected the objectivity of the intelligence services. So we're not investigating or obtaining reliable information to actually make the proper decisions.
worse yet, I would argue it's been actually weaponized now to the point where those intelligence services are seemingly focused on the threat of white supremacism inside the United States, which seems to be both unwarranted by the facts, but also completely at odds with their mission, which is supposedly, you know, overseas adversaries, understanding and helping effectively counter them. Lawrence, this is a deeply troubling conversation, I'm sorry to say, as increasingly are those we have with other guests. But I believe that we have a duty to make plain what is going on in and to our country. And you're shedding very important light on it, and I hope you'll continue to do so with us again in the near future. And we're appreciative of your time today, and Godspeed, my friend, and come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Lonnie Elliott. We'll drill down on another facet of this crisis with Afghanistan, namely what to do about the refugees. That and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The victorious Taliban are waging a new campaign in Afghanistan. It's called a charm offensive. Spokesmen say they intend to join the international community, respect the rights of women, and allow the emigration of what the Biden administration calls vulnerable people. These assurances are belied by the terrorist group's past behavior and the current actions of its operatives across the country. While reports of widespread summary executions, rapes, dismemberings, and enslavement are becoming increasingly difficult to verify, they cannot be ignored, if only because they are prescribed by Sharia, authoritative Islam's brutally repressive doctrine to which the Taliban faithfully adhere. The Taliban's Sharia supremacism portends terrible affliction for the long-suffering people of Afghanistan. It also endangers large numbers of Americans potentially trapped there. Ditto, the vulnerable people in this country, if we wind up inadvertently importing it here, along with unvetted Afghans. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And I want to express a special welcome and great appreciation to our next guest for his service to our country over many years. He's a new first-time interviewee, and I couldn't be more pleased to have him with us. His name is V.I. Elliott. He goes by Lenny. He is a 40-year veteran of the United States government's efforts to try, through principally the U.S. Agency for International Development, to address our foreign policy interests and help friendly nations and peoples as part of our leadership heretofore of the free world. Lenny has served in, among other roles, as a member of the Kampuchean Relief Task Force, and has been personally involved for quite some time in the refugee resettlement that was necessitated by our abandoning the Hmong in Laos, the Cambodians, and the Vietnamese in the course of the conflicts that we engaged in back in the 60s and 70s in Southeast Asia. He is the co-author of a Watershed World Bank study on civil war entitled Breaking the Conflict Trap. I want to say, Lenny, thank you for all of that service to our country, and welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, sir. The context for this conversation is Afghanistan, which we've just had a lengthy and very, I think, illuminating conversation with Dr. Lawrence Sellin about. But I want to go back to that time in Vietnam, and with respect to these other peoples of Southeast Asia, another moment of, I believe, great dishonor for our country when we abandoned them, having asked for their help in fighting their foe and ours, the communists of Vietnam, notably, and those that ultimately took control of other parts of Southeast Asia. As you reflect back on it, Lenny, talk about that moment in our nation's history, how it came about in the first place, and what its lasting consequences were.
Well, in 1972, the negotiated peace was really not much of a peace for the South Vietnamese. We agreed, our negotiators agreed to allow North Vietnamese troops to remain on South Vietnamese soil, and they immediately launched, as soon as U.S. troops were out, they launched the Easter Offensive of 1972, which the South Vietnamese, with U.S. air support and advisors, turned back at heavy cost on both sides. Then in 1975, when they came south, the entire North Vietnamese army of 26 divisions came down. They rolled through Laos, then Cambodia, then into Vietnam, and overturned the Laotian and Cambodian governments. It was pretty clear what was going on. We were all, I think, quite dismayed. Even those who were anti-war were a little shocked at what was going on, and that was just the beginning.
We undertook those negotiated arrangements with the North Vietnamese in a process not that different from what we've been watching play out lately with the Taliban, undermined by a lack of political support for the war effort, I think it's fair to say, but also animated, at least in part, by the sense that we'd lost and we had to just get out. So the ability to support the South Vietnamese in countering that incursion by the North Vietnamese army in 1975 was severely hampered by those constraints, was it not, and made essentially inevitable the outcome?
Yes, our training had been for an army somewhat similar to our own, and that included air support, which they themselves could not provide, and then supplies were cut off. Medical supplies, petroleum, ammunition, spare parts, they were in great difficulty there. And when
they were cut off by whom, Lenny?
Primarily the Congress. The class of 1974 came into Congress with a fairly common agenda among them, which was to end everything that we had to do with Southeast Asia, or certainly the war.
Yeah, a man who was very supportive of that at the time had entered Congress, the United States Senate specifically, I believe, 4 years before, namely Joe Biden. And so we're witnessing a similar kind of story today. But again, finish your thought here. This cutoff essentially precluded the South Vietnamese from defending their country. And what flowed as a result?
Well, as a result of that, the North Vietnamese came in very quickly. There was heavy fighting, particularly in the Three Corps area around Saigon, until basically they were out of ammunition in many instances, the South Vietnamese. And then the outflow began in massive numbers. We had merchant and naval vessels off the coast that were taking on thousands of Vietnamese refugees coming out. The Khmer, not many Cambodians could get out during that time. Those that could had to go out by foot, and primarily towards Thailand. And the Hmong and Laos were just abandoned, not by the individuals, but by the U.S. government.
How would you characterize, Lonnie, the success of our efforts to help those who could get out to make their way, and the magnitude of the damage done to those who could not get out?
Well, the people who could not get out are best illustrated by the Khmer, the Cambodians. When I left Cambodia in 1974, there were somewhere 1.75 and 2.5 million people in the country. When I went back to work on the task force, about half of those were dead. We were at points that in the early stages of that relief program where the experts were telling us the very survival of the Cambodian race biologically was at stake, and it was very difficult.
At the hands of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge genocidal regime.
Yes, that was, they were worked to death, starved to death, shot, about every means of killing someone that they could use, I guess they did, between the spring of 1975 and the winter of 1979.
And at the time, we stood idly by as it was taking place, right?
Yes. There was very little done. And then when we got in, it was largely the result of public pressure. But I must say that President Carter and Mrs. Carter especially were greatly shocked by what was going on and got the U.S. government moving. The State Department coordinated across the government. There was very large Department of Defense logistical support, and then there was a lot of international agencies involved. The government of Thailand was especially active along that Thai-Cambodian border.
So this was the Kampuchean Relief Task Force of which you were a part.
Yeah, that was 79. The refugees out of Vietnam had been coming by boat to Thailand, Malaysia, and the Philippines throughout those years.
And we did undertake to assimilate large numbers of them over time. And how was that affected? And what insights would you say are important to take away from that experience as we contemplate the possibility of large numbers of refugees from Afghanistan?
First, the involvement of the American people. The American people, during my time in the activities that we're talking about in out of Indochina, were very vocal in expressing their views to their elected representative and contributing to the NGOs, non-governmental organizations that were involved. Then the after the initial shock of these massive amounts coming out of Vietnam, a set of organizational arrangements were put in place where refugees could be assembled in a third country, gotten together with their family, screened, and then they would come to an American facility, those that were coming to the United States, Guam, and into some of the not heavily utilized American military bases in the U.S. And there was a very active program to match people from Indochina with sponsors here in the United States. That was done through a lot of the NGOs. The Red Cross was particularly involved, so were church groups. But one of the things I'd like to point out in all of this, you need to be very certain of your legal basis, your legislative basis, not only for budgetary support, but for the authority to take the expedited steps that are needed to get people in. And you're going to be dealing with a lot of people who have health issues, particularly now with the Wuhan virus going around. It's going to take a great deal of effort to mobilize the medical facilities and the personnel, which will be complicated to some degree by language differences. And you have to, at least in the initial phases, be able to build up your medical receiving capabilities in layers, probably about three or four deep, because you're going to exhaust people quite quickly.
There's another consideration here that I just want to tease out with you if I can. And again, our guest is Lonnie Elliott, who served for four decades in organizations like USAID, challenging, they're facing various challenges, including the consequences of our defeat in Vietnam and Southeast Asia more generally. Lonnie, when we look at the prospect of large numbers of refugees coming from Afghanistan, concern is being expressed about the degree to which they will not only face a huge, you know, culture shock and challenges that arise therefrom, but that especially if we are not entirely clear who these people are and what their backgrounds may be and what their beliefs are, ideology, if you will, or religious beliefs, as they bear upon, you know, things like, well, Sharia supremacism, for one thing, and the jihad that it commands. What insights, what lessons should we take away from the experience that you've just described for how to manage that prospect and minimize the potential risk to our country that could arise from it?
Well, beginning with the health screenings that we just discussed, then the national security screenings have to be affected, and affected with some considerable emphasis. I am uncertain about the data we have on people coming in, but I think you have to be very careful with who you bring into the United States on a permanent basis, because there are ideological factors that promote the use of violence, and we're dealing with cultural differences that go back a long way. We don't have much in common with a lot of the cultures in the area. In particular, the difference between a shame-based culture, which is dominant in that region, and one based upon individual responsibilities. So, I would hope that we would have something along training on what you and I would have known of as a civics education when we were going to school.
Back when there was such a thing in our schools. It's not clear we've got much of a basis for teaching it these days, given the lack of teaching about it to our own kids. But on this point, we have to leave it at this, Lonnie, but just a quick reaction, if I could get it from you. We are at considerable risk, I think it's fair to say, of having people who are not only culturally at a considerably different place than we are, but that may have an agenda that could create real problems from a security point of view. That was not much of a consideration in the case of the Vietnamese boat people, as I recall. And I just wonder how you would recommend we handle that possibility in this particular refugee context.
Well, the screening that will have to go on initially at in intermediate staging areas, like when people first come out of Afghanistan and get into some kind of secure environment and make the application process to come here and really to go anywhere, because any country is going to need to be sure of their security requirements. Those are going to have to be very intense and very capably manned. I don't know if we have on board the capacity to do that, you know, on manpower on board in the U.S. government. So it's probably going to be necessary to get legislative action and administrative direction to get people, retirees, contractors, et cetera, who have the training in the background to come on board and do the screening. Then you've got the process of the civics education we spoke of, and I don't know where we get that anymore.
This is, I don't either, and that's a very, very serious challenge. But the first question is, do we, in fact, take these folks to staging areas where they're vetted, or are they going to simply be brought here? At which point, unfortunately, they are afforded rights that may make it difficult to contend with problems and, if necessary, deport them. And that is a whole nother angle on this challenge that I think has not been thought through, has not been planned for, and could prove to be a very, very significant problem, especially if some of the numbers that are being bruited eventuate. So, Lenny, we'll be following this very closely, and I hope we'll be able to continue to tap your corporate memory and your good common sense, and thank you for your service to our country over so many years, and that you will continue to render in this case, I'm sure. Thank you to all of you for joining us today, and I hope you will join us again tomorrow for more of Secure Freedom Radio. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The victorious Taliban are waging a new campaign in Afghanistan. It's called a charm offensive. Spokesmen say they intend to join the international community, respect the rights of women, and allow the emigration of what the Biden administration calls vulnerable people. These assurances are belied by the terrorist group's past behavior and the current actions of its operatives across the country. While reports of widespread summary executions, rapes, dismemberings, and enslavement are becoming increasingly difficult to verify, they cannot be ignored, if only because they are prescribed by Sharia, authoritative Islam's brutally repressive doctrine to which the Taliban faithfully adhere. The Taliban's Sharia supremacism portends terrible affliction for the long-suffering people of Afghanistan. It also endangers large numbers of Americans potentially trapped there. Ditto, the vulnerable people in this country, if we wind up inadvertently importing it here, along with unvetted Afghans. This is Frank Gaffney.